the way nobles eat now looks very different from the way peasants do. All those rough and crass foods, the beans, the cabbage, the garlic, brown bread, those become strongly associated with lower classes. And the more noble foods, like the game birds and the expensive vegetables, artichokes and asparagus, and they're expensive because there's an intense market-driven agriculture that provides these, as well as white bread, expensive fish, those become very firmly associated with the wealthy classes.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 18, 16th Century Manners and Reformation Diets. In today's podcast, we're going to examine a fascinating new dynamic in culture that swept across Europe in the 1500s. We'll see the emergence of cutlery, elaborate tableware, and ritualized behavior at the table. We'll see the beginning of food ideologies that are distinct from courtly fashions, and we'll also observe the effect of religious reformations on eating habits, which produced new dietary freedoms, new fasting practices, and a moralistic thinking about food. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
I've spoken a bit about the 16th century when we did the Renaissance in Italy and covered Messus Bugo, but I'd like to go on to all of Europe today and discuss some other major changes that occur and that have some very interesting effects on food culture. We already discussed the biggest and the most important series of events, that's globalization of the economy and exchange of food across continents, but there are other important changes as we cross into the early modern period. The first of these is a demographic swell. The lull in population now reverses. Favorable economic times in the wake of the plague triggered the population to bounce back within a century and a half or so. That means by 1500, there is once again a serious baby boom. And the effect that this had on the economy was lots of people scrambling for jobs and the price of labor and wages going down. A scarcity of food meant that the cost of living, of course, rose because of inflation, some of the most dramatic price surges in history, and once again, land is at a premium. But as we all know, feudalism had pretty much fallen apart. Serfs had become peasants, renting land as tenants, and now if they were lucky enough to have good leases, or even better, if they were freeholders and owned the land themselves, they are in an excellent position, because they can now supply the growing market with food. They can reap a good profit because the prices are really high. And this leads to an industrious class of farmers who are, let's say, middle class. In England, they're called yeomen and other upper middle class gentry. They're not nobles, but they're sort of lesser titled landholders who usually do work the land rather than just rent it out. Now, the nobles themselves, because the demand and price of land is so high, also do very well. If they are large landowners, they do supremely well. You know, if they're investors in trade or colonization projects, they also tend to do very well. Remember, the prices for these goods are high. And if they invest in industries, they also do well, whether it's shipbuilding or textiles or glass manufacture, whatever it is. But notice something very important about these nobles. They're not allowed to run amok anymore, raping and pillaging, unless, of course, they're doing it in Mexico. But in Europe, unless they join a royal army, they've really lost their original military function. And the result is that they become, let's use this word again, domesticated. They go from being warriors to being courtiers. And revealingly, there's a whole literature devoted just to telling them how to behave. Books on manners, like Erasmus's famous tract, De Civilitate Morum Puerilium. It explains how to raise boys so they don't blow their noses at the table or put their dirty fingers in the plate or do anything else disgusting. And just as we've seen in other contexts, manners are a way of ritualizing behavior so you don't have to think about how to act, so you don't run the risk of offending or threatening other people. Remember, warriors with sharp knives at the table are dangerous. And over the years, knives become, interestingly, rounded at the tip. But even more importantly, at least for the history of food, there is finally a new implement so you don't have to touch your food at all. There are now forks. There were certain kinds of forks before. I mean, there's big two-pronged affairs for holding a piece of meat while carving it, or there's little ones for picking up stewed fruits and syrup, but there is not the fork as we know it, the three or more prongs used as an eating utensil until we get to really 16th century Italy. And it catches on naturally among the nobles who want to imitate courtly fashions, first in France, then later in Spain. England doesn't really catch on until the 17th century. But note why it's important. A fork distances you from your food. It distances you from that very animal act of grabbing. And just as other animal acts are increasingly hidden from sight, acts like sleeping, defecating, having sex, all of them have their own separate room now devoted to them. You know, you don't eat in the bathroom or have sex in the kitchen. Well, you might, but dining too eventually gets its own room, and that is the dining room. It's not just a trestle set up anywhere you want that you invite guests. Another important factor, this increasingly court-dominated society, is the general trend in most of the European powers for monarchies to grow power at the expense of the nobility. As the 16th century opens with a handful of strong, secure monarchies in place, and we're talking about Spain, France, England especially, all of these become financially secure by taxing their subjects more efficiently, by building up their bureaucracies, by strengthening their legal systems, and all of this is at the expense of the power of the nobles, who of course formerly had, you know, their own armies, their own legal courts, their own taxation systems. All that stuff is dismantled and taken over by the crown. So there's not only centralization, but even the growth of the physical territory of the crown. You know, we don't have a maze of independent powers anymore. We begin to have a true nation state. Why is this important for our story? Is that anyone who wants power now has to go through the king. He becomes the font of patronage, the person who appoints government positions as well as church positions. And more than ever, kings set the fashions. Anyone who is anyone eats whatever the king does, wears the latest style of clothes, buys a set of forks just like the king has, and patronizes artists like he does. And the result is a dazzling court culture that eventually trickles down from nobles to gentry to wealthy bourgeois businessmen and to professionals, and even in some cases to the wealthy yeoman farmers. And almost immediately, we see the level of material culture take a kind of great leap forward. What I mean is suddenly plates begin to replace the bread trenchers. Pottery, or if you're very wealthy, silver. You know, this is all part of the manners thing, the privatization of space. Everyone gets their own individual plate, their own cup that stays there, their own set of silverware, and nothing is grabbed from a common bowl anymore. It is served to you by this servant in gloves. And there's now a profusion of different kinds of tableware as well. You know, it's funny, depictions of medieval dining, they show relatively stark tables. You know, there just isn't a lot of stuff there. But when we get to the 16th century, there are huge serving platters and salt cellars and ewers for washing your hands and several different kinds of plates and dipping bowls and fantastic glasses of all sorts of shapes and sizes. All sorts of, let's say, table paraphernalia. Why is fashion? If you want an idea of how lavish table settings can get, take a look at a still life of Caravaggio or any 17th century Dutch still life. They're supposed to be warnings about the vanities of life, you know, memento mori, remember death. But they also very clearly show how opulent this culture has become. You know, there are always some gorgeous glasses out. There'll be a golden platter spilling over with fruits and vegetables or shellfish. They usually placed it on an expensive Persian rug. And interestingly, they put those right on top of the table. But you get the point, right? People with expendable income, want to show off their wealth and flaunt it a bit. And now there is some great stuff around to buy. But what about the other half, the rabble, the poor starving masses? One way to look at their plight might be to consider that for all the wealth that's accumulating at the upper end of the social scale, someone else is going hungry. Lots of people, low wages, high prices. That means that the diet of the average European becomes dramatically worse. One historian has called it depecoration. It means a greater proportion of the household income has to be spent on grain, and consequently less and less on meat. And it becomes glaringly obvious that eating customs come to be increasingly associated with class. In other words, the way nobles eat now looks very different from the way peasants do. All those rough and crass foods, the beans, the cabbage, the garlic, brown bread, those become strongly associated with lower classes. And the more noble foods, like the game birds and the expensive vegetables, artichokes and asparagus, and they're expensive because there's an intense market-driven agriculture that provides these, as well as white bread, expensive fish, those become very firmly associated with the wealthy classes. Now, there were certainly social distinctions before, right? I mean, we remember game, you know, as appropriate for nobles. But European society becomes increasingly stratified. There are now more and more ways to eat, more and more prejudices based on class, and more food ideologies. There's noble dining on one end. There's monastic dining still. Those have been there before. But now there's a kind of bourgeois cooking developing for people in cities. There's country gentry cooking. There is a slew of diet books published that discuss how to eat a healthy diet. And of course, there's all these become increasingly distinct from what peasants and laborers eat. And people from the upper classes won't dare degrade themselves by eating foods associated with peasants. What they usually want to do is imitate those above them, their superiors. But not always. And I think many unique food niches are carved out in conscious distinction now from the courtly fashions. And that's in fact exactly what diet books do. They don't think it's healthy to eat dozens of courses and a perverse variety of food, which is of course what courtiers do. They think there should be a kind of order to every meal. They argue that some foods are easier to digest than others. Some push the other foods down. Some seal the stomach after a meal. In fact, the idea that cheese should always come at the end of a meal as a kind of stopper for the stomach, but never fruits or melons or peaches, because those float on the top of the stomach contents and corrupt, and those would send foul vapors up into your brain and cause all sorts of diseases. So my point, larger point, is that it's no longer a simple matter of imitation of the upper crust. There are now separate and distinct foodways for a variety of different kinds of people who want to remain distinct, not only from peasants below them, but even from the courtiers above them. And what that reflects, I think, is an increasingly stratified society, more and more unique fashions, which is, of course, what it's like today, right? We have dozens of different ways of eating. And I don't mean different ethnic cuisines. I mean different food ideologies. We have vegetarianism there. We have, you could argue, Southern barbecue as a whole ideology unto itself, fast food, haute cuisine. And I think that reflects our very complex society. You know, we like to think of ourselves as classless, but just stop and think of how vividly class-oriented our food prejudices are. You know, I could probably name a food and you could tell me exactly who eats it. You know, think chitlins, think truffles, think extra virgin olive oil, think lard. You know, it's partly an ethnic thing, but it's also really a class thing. There are class associations with individual foods. There's another very big important series of events that has a profound effect on eating habits across Europe. And this is the Reformations. And what I mean by that is the Protestant, Catholic, and Radical Reformations. And let me go into a little detail about this because it's something I've been working on in recent years. And I think it's important for understanding the attitude toward food in the early modern era. Well, let's think about everything we've discussed regarding medieval Christianity. There was one church for all of Europe, excluding the East, of course. There was monasticism with its ascetic attitude toward food. There was this whole fast and feast mentality of peasants. There's a carnival and Lent, dreams of the land of cocaine, and most importantly, the central ritual of Christianity, the Eucharist, in which the communion wafer transforms into the actual body of Christ, according to the doctrine of transubstantiation, which was in place since 1215.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from World War II, natural healing, human decision-making, how ideas spread, archaeology, music appreciation, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
Now, at the start of the early modern period, there was a mounting, let's say, considerable reaction to what were considered abuses of the medieval church. Most of all, it was the wealth and profligacy, but also the failure of priests to live up to their vows of chastity, the sale of church offices, what was perceived as clerical ignorance, and I would say a general failure of the church to meet the spiritual needs of people who were largely alienated by rituals that were still in Latin. It didn't help that a number of questionable individuals occupied the papal throne. Think of the fun-loving bon vivant Leo X, or the warrior pope Julius II. They may have been great patrons of the art, no doubt, but as spiritual leaders, many people considered them failures. Humanist scholars were also concerned that the church had lost sight of its original intentions, those of Jesus and his followers, which was moral reform, and instead they'd begun to focus on the hollow rituals and the letter of the law. Now, this picture of the church is somewhat simplistic, admittedly, because on the eve of the Reformation, ordinary people were still making pious benefactions to their local churches. They were still venerating the church relics scattered across Europe. They were still even going on pilgrimages. All these were ways to gain merit and earn salvation. So I think it would be a mistake to see the medieval church and its practices as completely corrupt and doomed to failure. Nonetheless, this rift in the church is essential for understanding the history of food, because along with the criticism of the dogma and the rituals of the church, its food strictures also came under direct attack. Starting with Martin Luther, the Reformation was first and foremost an attempt to return to the original doctrines of Paul that stated that an individual can in no way earn his own salvation. The rituals, the donations, the observing the moral laws and fasting, those do not gain you merit with God in a way that would compel him to grant you salvation. The doctrine is called justification by faith alone, and despite our own failings, grace or forgiveness is given even to the worst of sinners as long as they have true faith. And these are ideas that Martin Luther articulated in his 95 Theses. These are basically topics that were kind of nailed onto the cathedral door at Wittenberg University, meant to be for discussion among theology students. Luther himself had taken holy orders. In fact, he found the ascetic rigors he underwent extremely frustrating, because he could never be exactly sure when God would be satisfied and when he'd done enough to merit salvation. And I think Paul's doctrines offered him a kind of comfort because they assured him that without any merit on his part, he could still be saved as long as he had faith. And it was this single idea, really, that hastens the permanent rift in Western Christendom. Because if the rituals are not crucial, then what use are the sacraments, the priesthood, and especially the tithes that are being paid to the church? Significantly, Luther was really not that concerned with the rituals themselves, nor did he care about overhauling church government. But his challenge drew the attention of the masses of peasants who were resentful of the power of the church, as well as temporal rulers who welcomed an increase in their own power. And ultimately, Luther came under the protection of German rulers like the Elector of Saxony, which meant that the Reformation would be carried out essentially by the state. The German Lutheran states broke away from the Roman Catholic Church first and then abolished monasticism and clerical celibacy. The Mass was also held in German, and the congregation was encouraged to participate directly by singing of hymns. And if you remember, Luther composed many of those himself. But the church government and its rituals, that all remained relatively unchanged. But on the topic of fasting, Luther believed that if an individual chose to fast, it was sort of like any other spiritual exercise. It can be of use as long as that person understands that it doesn't gain you merit. But the idea that the Pope could sell dispensations from fasting, along with things like indulgences, he thought that was plainly erroneous, especially since most people couldn't afford these dispensations in the first place. And Luther said people in Germany were forced to use oil during Lent, which people back in Rome would not grease their shoes with. But yet they sell us permission to eat butter and other things in spite of the Holy Apostle who says that the gospel gives us complete freedom to do anything. And Luther, of course, was right. Early Christians had no food prohibitions at all. And considering that it is not what goes into the mouth, but what comes out, in other words, evil words that defiles a man, but in his mind, another quote, they think that eating butter is a greater sin than lying, swearing, or even committing fornication. So in the end, fasting among Lutherans was no longer officially enforced, but individuals, they were sort of encouraged to fast privately. But with the possibility of abolishing all dietary restrictions looming on the horizon, the humanist, our friend Desiderius Erasmus, composed this satirical dialogue in 1526. This is the early years of the Reformation, a dialogue between a fishmonger and a butcher, wondering which one would fare better if everyone was suddenly freed from observing Lent. It's called Concerning the Eating of Fish. And the fishmonger thinks, well, meat would no longer be valued so much if it weren't forbidden. And the butcher says he's sure that the church would allowed meat, it would be in conformity with basic nutritional principles that said that cold and moist fish can only cause disease in the cold months, which is, of course, Lent. And they go on sort of accusing each other, one saying, fish stink, we know that's true, and other butchers pass off cats and dogs and rabbits as other animals. So eventually, this whole restriction discussion blossoms into a discourse on how the laws and fasts of the Old Testament were abrogated by the New. And yet a multitude of new food restrictions has somehow arisen. And Erasmus was really the last of a breed of humanist thinker who could still be critical of the Catholic Church's arbitrary rules, yet remain loyal to it. And in the ensuing decades, it became clear that as Protestants started abolishing practices like fasting, the Catholics actually clung ever more tightly to them. In the wake of Luther's first decisive break with Rome, a number of other Reformation movements sprang up, and I think one of the most important of these occurred in Zurich in Switzerland. The Swiss Reformation actually provides a model for many other reform movements, and it actually ignites over a plate of sausages. 1534, this printer, Christopher Froschauer, decides that his men have a big heavy workload of printing, and they need some more sustenance, and he serves them a plate of sausages, and it's during Lent. Of course, he never bothers to pay for a dispensation, so he is arrested, hauled before the city magistrates, and duly charged. And suddenly, fighting breaks out in the streets, and the local preacher, Ulrich Zwingli, preaches a sermon in defense of the printer. And his logic is that if the Bible is a guide to worship, and there are no regularly scheduled fasts, and even no particular foods that are prohibited there, if we decide to fast as individuals, then it should really be complete abstinence of food, just like in the New Testament. Or if we decide to fast collectively, maybe to appease God's wrath, that's also something they did in the Old Testament all the time, then it should be a real fast. It should be no food, and it should be serious penitence. There should be wailing and sackcloth, and we should toss ashes on our head. So in the Reformed traditions, which include not just the Swiss, but the Dutch, the Scots, the French Huguenots, the English, and even the New England Puritans, those are all Calvinists. Fasting doesn't really disappear, but it changes into an entirely communal event for emergent occasions. And I should mention also its counterpart, Thanksgiving, as a feast, that's not a regularly scheduled event. That's something that you do on a special occasion, like when the first Canadians, you know, arrived safely, they had a Thanksgiving for a successful harvest. And it was the same in New England. Equally important is that no food is ever forbidden. And I think this actually has culinary consequences as well. Whereas before, there was this separation of milk, butter, and dairy products, and of course, meat too, from fish and vegetables seasonally. Well, they can now be combined any time of year. So fish in butter and cream sauces, I think, is a good example of this new possibility. Zwingli is also important because he said the whole idea that we are actually eating the flesh and drinking the blood of Jesus in the Mass is a form of cannibalism. The Eucharist is only a memorial. Jesus says, "Remember me when you eat and drink." He didn't mean this, this is my body literally. And I should also mention that the most influential thinker in the Reformed tradition, this is John Calvin, who practically governed the whole town of Geneva, his importance is primarily in the formation of a system of church government called Presbyterianism, in which the hierarchical structure of Rome is replaced with a more democratic system of elders who decide doctrine at these collective meetings or synods of church elders. But Calvin's attitude towards food is equally interesting. And in fact, it's similar, and I think at some level drawn from the Stoics. Calvinists favored austerity and rigorously guilt-ridden attitude towards all pleasures of the flesh. And it's significant that while asceticism of the kind practiced by medieval monastics really disappears in Calvinist countries, there's a new kind of personal simplicity and a basic distrust of elegant food that flourishes among the population at large. And just as they considered all righteous people to be saints, they also expected them to act as such, and they enforced morality by any means necessary. Arguably, puritanical thought more than any other factor quelled the spread of culinary refinement in Calvinist countries. And it's been argued also that the doctrine of predestination, the idea that only some people are destined to be saved, goaded people into looking for signs of their election, which meant material prosperity. And hence, it has been argued by Max Weber that there is a Protestant work ethic, and these people tend to invest their money rather than squandering it, as they do in Catholic countries. Now, as I mentioned, Calvinist countries reinstated public fasting as a way to atone for sins. In England, these were called political fasts, intended purely and I think pragmatically to force people to buy fish to maintain the fleets for defense, and also to keep meat at a good low price. But during the interregnum, when Puritans came into power, they made no such excuses. They would declare public fasts to gain God's favor in times of political crisis or even, bizarrely enough, during famines. That makes no sense. But despite the return of the fast, the carnival celebrations that preceded it are definitively banned in the course of the 16th and 17th century. They smack too much of paganism. Their violence and license could not be tolerated inside a morally righteous nation, so that the overt cycle of feast and fast is definitely broken, as ordinary people were expected to maintain simple habits throughout the year and austere ones on certain occasions. Now, beneath these official or magisterial Reformation movements, as they're often called, the ones that were implemented by temporal rulers, there's also a broad variety of popular movements. Most of these people are called Anabaptists, and that's at first a term of abuse. It means a rebaptizer, because, of course, they only baptized adults to start with. Their descendants are the Mennonites and the Amish. The Quakers are not directly descended, but they're related. In Pennsylvania, of course, the Hutterites, in the Dakotas. And these people live a different way. They're not only pacifists, but they live in separate communities. And they tend to retain unique food customs and recipes, primarily because they keep apart from others. Now, I'll come back to those people when we get to the American foodways. But it was not until the mid-16th century that the Catholic Church mounted its own major reform movement, primarily through the Council of Trent. And in a nutshell, the council decided that instead of abandoning the ritual aspects of Christianity, they would strengthen them. So the Mass becomes the central part of worship. It's elevated to this glittering, majestic, even a kind of theatrical event that stresses, once again, the miracle of transubstantiation. The role of the priest as a celibate and now increasingly learned intermediary with God is also stressed. And new churches are built with dazzling ornamentation. And in fact, by the 17th century, there's a new style of architecture, which becomes the perfect vehicle for expressing this new energetic religiosity. It's called the Baroque. But of course, in strengthening doctrine and ritual, the church was also forced to crack down on heterodox practices, local festivals that still retained their pagan elements, the odd customs that didn't fit in with the exacting definition of the sacraments. So just as in Protestant countries, carnival celebrations were among the first to go, particularly because they lacked the decorum that seemed fitting for a religious celebration. Among Catholic Reformation thinkers, there is also a new attitude toward food, and one that can be gleaned directly through writings like those of St. Francis de Sales. In his Introduction to the Devout Life, although he's actually discussing sex, de Sales tells us how we should approach food. First, he acknowledges eating is necessary to maintain life, and therefore it is a duty. But it also serves a social function, and thus, like reproduction, it is a virtuous act. But eating only to satisfy our appetite, it could be tolerated, but it's not itself praiseworthy. And of course, eating to excess is dangerous, and he says it is an infallible mark of a wayward, infamous, base, abject, and degraded mind to think about food and drink before mealtime, much more so to delight ourselves later with the pleasure we had in eating. Which is a shame. That seems the whole pleasure to me. But anyway, of course, for a human being anticipating and remembering foods, the pleasures associated with food, well, in any case, this straightforward and methodological approach to eating, and maybe sex too, appears to be an effort to offer the new kind of religiosity to ordinary people without alienating them, unlike the unattainable stories of heroic fasting. But the greatest effect the Catholic Reformation has on the eating habits of ordinary people is that periods of fasting are rigorously maintained. Monastic orders flourish in southern Europe, and a whole slew of new miracle-working saints appear, some performing incredible feats of self-denial. On the other hand, the church retained its fabulous wealth, and high-ranking churchmen and wealthy monasteries remained significant patrons of the arts and, of course, of refined cuisine. So, in the next lecture, we'll take a closer look at that cuisine, starting in papal Rome and then moving on to Spain in its golden age.
Thanks for listening to episode 18 of Food, a Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from Barbarians of the Steppes, How to Be an Entrepreneur, Brain Fitness, Growing Trees and Shrubs, you name it. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.